Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Founded on Cinco de Mayo in 1984 in San Francisco's Historic Mission District, Culture Class is Richard Montoya, Rick Salinas, and Herbert Siguenza. And we get one of them tonight, one third of the team. They're now based in Los Angeles, and the trio uses performance collage to bring history, geography, urban excavation, forensic poetry, and storytelling together in a contemporary, movable theater narrative through a Chicano point of view, what Guillermo Gomez Peña describes as reverse anthropology. I was going to tell a funny story about Guillermo, but I think I won't right now. The company has recently completed their cycle of California plays, Chavez Ravine, Zorro in Hell, and Water and Power, and their theatrical work also includes The Mission, Unplugged, Copra Clash, Border Town, The Birds, Anthology, Mission Magic Mystery Tour, Señor Discretion himself, and Culture Clash in America, as well as Aristophanes' piece performed at the Getty Villa last summer, which was fantastic. How many of you saw it? It was really, really great. Their new play is Palestine, New Mexico, which is about assumptions we make about each other, a sense of tribe and ethnicity, and how that's not always what it seems. It's about a fallen soldier, an American, a Native American, and it's a play in which a U.S. Army captain named Catherine Seiler journeys to the New Mexico reservation home of Private First Class Raymond Birdsong on a search for answers. The questionable circumstances surrounding Ray's death in Afghanistan create a crisis of conscience for the captain, giving her no choice but to re-examine her own life along the way. Richard Montoya, the playwright of Palestine, New Mexico, and one-third of the equal opportunity offenders that make up Culture Clash, tonight we'll discuss the creative process behind the play with Mike Sablone, the literary associate at Center Theater Group. Mike has served as the dramaturg on a number of world premiere productions. He might even explain to us just what a dramaturg does, including Culture Clash's Palestine, New Mexico at CTG. So without further ado, please welcome Richard Montoya and Michael Sablone. Thank you.
You guys mind if we eat? Is that okay?
We're going to eat grapes, Greek style.
Thank you very much. Hey, Richard.
Hey, man.
How's it going?
Good. Good to be here.
Congratulations on opening yesterday.
Oh, man. I'm still hungover. But
you know what's funny is that was my first question. You opened last night. When did you sober up?
All day and walking around Echo Park. It was great. It was a great night. It was a great night.
It was. Well, I think, you know, the first thing I'd like to talk about is we'll start at the beginning with Culture Clash. You guys are currently celebrating your 25th anniversary, and I'd love if you could talk, just sort of give a quick historical background on Culture Clash, how you guys formed, and sort of your path leading up to Palestine.
Wow.
You have 30 seconds.
25 years. We just, I'm losing audience already.
Man, I'm sorry. I promise I'll be better for
that. That's what happened on our first night in San Francisco. I didn't even open my mouth. I was like, what the hell with him? Is she coming back? Thank God.
We should do this more often.
I'm not going to.
Thank you guys very much. It's been a great night.
Good night. We have a Christmas party to get to. what is it? The fourth night of Hanukkah tonight? Happy holidays, everybody. It's funny because we just celebrated our 25th at Royce Hall, and that took 5 hours. It was a five-hour show at Royce Hall. And
you can have 5 hours.
Yeah, we barely made it through the first 10 years. But it was really simple. It was just 1984 and working with a curator and an artist named Renee Yanez up in San Francisco, who had a really beautiful, important gallery in the Mission District of San Francisco called Galería de la Raza, Studio 24. Lots of combustive, important things went on in the Mission District in 84. And lots of performance art was happening in San Francisco at that time. And comedy clubs were all over. And so it was a really interesting time. I mean, the Chicano Teatro that we knew from the 70s had begun to wane a bit. I mean, Teatro Campesino had seen its bigger days. And at one time, there were almost 70 political Chicano theater companies in California.
I thought you were going to say San Francisco.
Of different levels, you know. And Campesino was at the top of that food chain. But and so that was a highly explosive period. And we were kind of kids of that, coming out of that into the 80s. And we were simply wanting to do a one night only on Cinco de Mayo, 84, a comedy show, a mixed bag of sketch and stand-up and some performance, but pretty much comedy. And it wasn't really received all that well, you know, because the movement was still very, you know, much alive. And then there was a little something going on in El Salvador at the time. And people felt, especially in the Bay Area, politicized as it is, that it just wasn't time for comedy or, you know, the movement didn't. I remember reading one article, "Welcome back."
Thank you.
It's okay. Bless your heart.
We've gotten a lot better.
Are you okay?
A lot better now.
You're looking good. Strong. Very strong.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't saying anything exciting. It's fine.
Poor lady. We were all focused on her. Now. But you've interrupted us now. No, I'm kidding. Poor thing. It's okay. This will continue, this dialogue that we're having.
Your questions are probably more exciting than mine, so.
And you know, people wanted our heads. I mean, we were, there was one review that was like, you know, it's the movement, it's too early, you know, to send the clowns in, you know, to the movement. And so, you know, that's partly what we were aiming to do, is to be provocative. But, you know, we were bringing Che Guevara back from the dead, and we were doing Frida Kahlo dating service, and we were doing some of the very first lesbian comics in Marga Gomez and Monica Palacios. I mean, it was, we literally ran out of some towns, you know, that weren't ready for.
Did that empower you?
Vaudeville. Well, I mean, it was a rocky first year until we began to find our footing, and that there was a thing called satire, and then there was political humor, and, you know, there was different ways to use the toolbox, and we didn't just have to, you know, piss people off, excuse my language, but and then we found ways to deepen and even darken the humor and learn how to use that tool, the blade, or, you know, whatever you call it. But I think in the beginning we were, you know, pretty controversial and a little bit punk rock. It was 84, for God's sakes, you know, and we came kicking and screaming. We didn't we weren't that much into magic realism, and
thank you for that.
We did own a strobe light at that time. All you had to do to do magic realism was have a strobe light and kill a chicken. And
it's true. It's actually in.
You were Marquesian at that time.
But, it's in the rules.
But performance artist Guillermo Gomez Pena was killing a chicken on stage at that time, and that was, you know, I mean, you name it, and we were trying to do it, you know, and but they were heady times, and they were really great. I mean, it's still part of our DNA. We're still a performance oriented group. We were born in an art gallery. There was art all around us. There was, you know, from there we ventured into the cafes and the peñas, the co-op cafe performance venues of Berkeley and Palo Alto and San Francisco. And There was a whole new vaudeville movement that was coming out of San Francisco at that time, which produced Bill Irwin and other huge people that, you know, moved on, Jeff Hoyle. And so there was a mix of that. And Teatro Campesino was still, you know, very much in the mix at the time. So it was the gay and lesbian comedy venues of Market, south of Market, and Mission District were just explosive. I'm convinced there was much more going on in San Francisco than Los Angeles at that time. I think it has shifted since. And I think we were rivaling New York, really, because you could go to venues in south of Market in San Francisco, and there was a place called Motel 9, which was a performance hotel. There were 32 rooms with shows going on in every motel room, and not pornographic, but there was a little bit of that.
Come on, don't describe it.
It was San Francisco at south of Market after all. But no, I mean, there was just really viable dangerous kind of, the lines were blurred between stand-up and performance art and theater, and a shake-up we felt really kind of needed to happen, because either the boring plays or a kind of a Euro three-act structure of a play, or, you know, that sort of thing, we didn't know what it was. I mean, we were kind of putting down classic theater and really not knowing what a Greek play was or what Shakespeare was.
Well, what brought you to the theater in the first place? What, why theater?
Well, from the gallery and performance spaces and even the stand-up comedy clubs, a couple years into Culture Clash, about 86 or 87, we met at one of these big theater conferences in San Antonio, Texas. We met Jose Luis Valenzuela, who is a professor at UCLA now and heads up the new LATC, the Latino Theater Company, on Spring Street. And way back then, Jose Luis was very clear in telling us that, you know, I'd really love to bring you to LA and work with you, but you have to do a play. You have to move into theater. So we set about writing a play about our lives and our experiences called The Mission, which is where we lived in the Mission District of San Francisco, and it seemed to make sense that we would be taken a little more seriously if we weren't just a sketch comedy group, and then we could move into these other venues, theaters, and later in the journey we would move into, you know, regional theaters and great places all around. It gave us new life. I don't know how long we would have lasted as a comedy troupe, but it became really clear sometime in the late 90s that it kind of wanted to kill off that idea as a comedy troupe, because it was dismissive, and we were writing plays now and taking longer, darker looks at our experiences.
I have a quote that's from one of the Los Angeles Times articles recently that says, "Over time, Culture Clash has transitioned from doing mainly sketch comedy, or political cabaret in your formulation, to nervy, full-blown scripted works," which pictures that. But I guess I'm sort of interested in how that transition worked. Like, when you first sat down to write The Mission, how was that? Was it difficult to sort of like, okay, well, I have to figure out what a play is, and are there certain things I have to do, or were you just sort of like, we're just going to make a play our own? I mean, it seems that way now that you've made plays your own, but how was that in the first early stages? Was it difficult?
You know, we just didn't know better, you know? It was like, hey, what do you want to say? Okay. What do you want to say? Oh, great. Okay, that sounds good. And because it was autobiographical, we kind of just followed our ridiculous path to, you know, wanting to conquer the world, or, you know, ambition, or wanting to write, you know, the perfect play, or to make it. Or I remember in the mid '80s, there was a lot of talk about crossing over and selling out, and what would we do in order to get there. And so that was on our minds a lot. Like, you know, would we become like, you know, Menudo was very big back then. The band, not the soup. I mean, there was some ridiculous stuff going on back then that was, and then the 80s were the decade of the Hispanic, you know, and that was hollow, and that turned out to be a weekend sponsored by Coors, or a T-shirt, or that we were on another kind of path, like so the first effort was effortless, you know. It was like we were in a small apartment in the Mission District, and I remember we just put up butcher paper on the wall, and it was kind of like painting a mural, you know, in a way. My friend Ernest is here. He's a muralist. I mean, it was that public kind of feeling, that, and friends coming by, and, hey, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this crazy thing, and really modular and sketch, very, very, you know, a series of sketches with a very paper-thin narrative. I just described Palestine, New Mexico. But there are...
I was going to say that even with the butcher paper, that's sort of how some of the beginning early stages of Palestine were. Sort
well,
of like,
our,
let's throw up some paper on the wall and
our director, Lisa Peterson, that's the first thing she asks for, you know, in the room. You know, from those days of just writing and, you know, drinking beer and writing and that, to now when we set about to write a play, I mean, there's a couple people from Yale in the room. We don't write plays without a Yale rep representing in the room.
I'm not one of them.
Because
no offense to anyone from Yale that's in the group. They want to kill me now.
Yeah, it's not a demand that we make, but just our team that we've worked with over the years. I mean, Lisa has happened to, you know, come through there, and John Glore, the dramaturg. I mean, these things take teams of people. You've got your writing table, and that's a very private matter, and then it goes in the rehearsal hall, and that's a very public, you know, matter, and the public part of it, I mean, you just learn to trust these people. I mean, so we've gone from just the three of us, and the mission was very kind of wild and had that, there's parts of that process that we still try to keep alive to this day, even if the team has expanded and the stakes are higher, and we try to keep that camaraderie alive.
Yeah,
part of the DNA.
Yeah. I want to backtrack a little bit. What caused the move to Los Angeles?
Well, our first trip to LA was this weird gig at East LA College. Our first gig in LA was LA Trade Tech with Ruben Blades and this massive kind of concert, and we kind of seemed to touch a nerve and thought, holy cow, there's a huge audience in Los Angeles. And in San Francisco, there's a really small audience. I mean, it's I swear we saw the same 20 people at every show. And all the other theaters
back.
Are competing for those same 20 people. A couple disgruntled screenwriters. It's like performing in Taos, New Mexico. We performed for six Jewish guys in Taos. And couldn't get on the reservations and all that. But back to coming to L.A., and then we had a couple other gigs, an East L.A. College gig, and some of them were, like, just fantastic, like, failures. Like, I remember we kind of second-guessed our East L.A. audience, and it wasn't a college crowd. It was another big kind of concert thing, and we wanted to project a Luis Buñuel film and wear paper fashions created by Diane Gamboa, and we came in, and the audience was just like, you know, the hell are you guys doing? Because we thought we were still in that art gallery, but one thing we knew for certain was that the audience was huge down here and hungry, and kind of feeling like we were, like that decade of the Hispanic had left out a lot of things, and that there was still room to be critical and satirical and that sort of thing. So we didn't really plan to move, and it would take several more years, but. Catching the tail end of LATC at Spring Street with Bill Bushnell and Jose Luis in late 80s, early 90s, we caught that audience that was very just alive, and there was a lot going on at LATC back in those times. Buck Henry would be in a theater or Tom Waits would be in another theater, and Ed Harris would literally be hanging from the rafters in the lobby, like threatening to leap off. And those were crazy, wonderful, you know, times. There was a year there where LATC, I mean, it was kind of the place. I mean, I remember seeing guys like Oscar Eustace and Gordon Davidson in that audience, you know, coming to see what was going on. Oscar would later move on to be artistic director of Trinity Rep and then the Public Theater in New York. But that was part of where we came from also. I remember doing a show at Eureka Theater Company in San Francisco in the Mission
District.
Oscar
was before. Yeah.
And the Eureka Theater was basically Tony Taccone from Berkeley Rep, Oscar, and Tony Kushner. I mean, look what those three guys have done to American theater. You know, just...
A small play called Angels in America.
Yeah. And Caroline in Change.
Caroline or Change, yeah.
And so, you know, coming out of that, we left all that to come down to Los Angeles and basically for a larger audience and a place to work and really jump into it, you know, full time as theater guys.
Now, to throw back what you said earlier, you know, with the punk rock aesthetic, was there ever a moment where you got called out for selling out by coming down to LA, or did people, or did your friends in San Francisco and the Bay Area sort of embrace that change?
You know, there's a lot of misinfo up there with, I still find, you know, like San Francisco, there used to be this kind of joke where, you know, artists in San Francisco were insecure about people in LA, and people in LA didn't even know we existed up there, you know. But there was a lot going on up there, you know. There was a lot of, the San Francisco Mime Troupe was still very strong. You know, there was always good theater going on in the Bay Area. But to find that larger Chicano audience, it had to be Los Angeles. We'd kind of maxed out what we could do in San Francisco. So I don't remember ever being called a sellout, but a funny thing happened on the way to, Los Angeles is that the Mission very much poked fun at television and trying to make it and, you know, what would later become kind of an American Idol, you know, society. And what happened in that play that was pretty critical about that was that folks from that industry came to, you know, purchase, you know. And so we were trying to figure out, you know, do we want to go to Fox? Do we want to go to CBS? And then another project, was it HBO or was it, you know, PBS? And not really knowing better, you know, and that... As Eddie almost would tell us later, you know, it takes another 15 years to get back into that sort of, that part of the industry where people are vying for you and want you. But in between, you know, the theater provided a great place for us, a place where we could say what was on our mind and make an honest living and that sort of thing. But the message was clear. We could live and work and be artists in Los Angeles. Oddly enough, and all of our friends in San Francisco have really moved out of San Francisco because they got priced out, you know, even during and after the dot-com bubble there. Like, most of the artist friends we know that made the Mission District what it was are living in the Richmond Annex, or, you know, imagine living in Richmond, California, when you really want to be in this place called the Mission District, or where it once thrived and so many wonderful things were going on there.
Let's jump forward to Palestine. Now, I'm not sure, you know, Palestine, we just opened yesterday, so I'm not sure how many people here have had a chance to see it or not. By the way, tickets are available, so I expect all of you to purchase at least 4 tickets when you leave. At least, yes. But I'm going to start off with a brief synopsis that I'm going to read off a cue card, which is embarrassing, but otherwise I'll ramble on for a lot of the intricacies. But... U.S. Army Captain Catherine Seiler journeys to the New Mexico reservation home of Private First Class Raymond Birdsong on a search for answers. The questionable circumstances surrounding Ray's death in Afghanistan create a crisis of conscience for the captain, giving her no choice but to re-examine her own life along the way. That's a brief little teaser. Now we're going to get in a little bit more specifics, starting off with the most basic of questions. What was the impulse? Why this play? Why now?
Well, you know, I feel like I've been on this multicultural exploration to figure out some things. And, you know, I worked pretty hard in the Southwest area on the Obama campaign with legions of other people. And it just seemed to be a good time to keep that exploration going. Like, who are we? What are we? And what makes us who we are? And New Mexico has always interested me because as a child we'd go there because my father's from there. That's where his side of the Montoya family are from, parts around Albuquerque. And during the Obama campaign leading up to the convention in Denver, I would just drive through New Mexico to get up, you know, and work in Texas and the primaries and all the way through to Denver. And just traveling up and down that Highway 25 that goes from Las Cruces through Albuquerque, Santa Fe, then across to Las Vegas, and then up into South Colorado and up into Denver. I just really loved the landscape, and it seemed to be a physical landscape, but also kind of a mental landscape, and a place where there's so much sky and so much desert and so much red rock and, you know, places to really, it seemed like a great place to hide secrets. And there's always been whispers and hushed conversations that I remember hearing my aunts and my uncles and about the Montoyas of New Mexico. And was there a Sephardic connection and the family? And why does Dad look like Steven Spielberg? And why do all my aunts look like Yentas from Fiddler? I was like, why is everyone hysterical? Why do we have expressive hand movements in our family? And there would be laughter like that, but then, you know, somebody would reveal something that, you know, well, you know, there was possibilities of marriages and people possibly marrying into a family and you know, just a little bit of research can tell you that you know, other people are on the case, like younger generations of people that want to know and have asked their parents who they are and, you know, what's this and what's that and why was there a menorah found in the barn and what is that? And so it just uncovered this very alive, raw feelings about the possibility of darker Jews being able to marry into families and live among the New Mexicans that were wildly different. I mean, you've got the Native American, you've got the Hispanos, you've got the New Mexicans, you've got this kind of very alive palette in which to, you know, create the story of Palestine, New Mexico. So it is very much about the effects of war and this captain coming to the res to tell the chief that his son died under her command, which he knows, but she suspects friendly fire or foul play. So there's secrets in the military and there are secrets on this reservation, and they culminate and collide into each other at hopefully.
They do.
Yeah.
There's two warring tribes that, well, just go see. Again, I don't want to give too much away because you're all going to buy 4 tickets when you leave today. Great.
But it's a great time, and we didn't plan it that it would coincide with the holidays or the fact that our current administration will send, you know, 30 to 40,000 more, you know, troops into battle. But, you know, it just, life seems to kind of collide this way, and so it seems just a great time to kind of keep exploring those kinds of issues.
Well, along those lines, I mean, one of the great things about in developing the play is that, you know, we've been working on this play for 2 years, a little bit under 2 years, I guess, or so, when we commissioned.
Yeah, it feels like about 2.5.
About 2.5 years when Center Theater Group commissioned Richard After Water and Power to write another play. And, you know, up until, I would guess, maybe about 5 months ago, the backstory of where the U.S. Army captain was Iraq.
And then you had switched it to Afghanistan right before we went to rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And so the play has this amazing sort of sense of evolving as the nation was evolving or devolving, depending upon your military stance. But I wanted to talk about sort of how much of the moment do you feel your writing is, and how difficult is that to sort of... do you ever feel like you're sort of trying to wrestle, like, a really... this is going to be a terrible metaphor that I'm not even going to go down the road, but, like, a big horse that's sort of running away from you. Like, do you ever feel like you're trying to, like, really bridle a horse that's sort of like, oh, well, now it's Afghanistan, and now there's this that just happened in the news that I'd like to put in? Or how much of that influences you?
Well, it's a fine line, but I think... well, as an artist, I just, you know, I don't want to be chasing things. I don't want to be chasing the culture... but I really want to be paying attention, you know,
responding,
to it,
yeah,
and responding so that, you know, we don't have something that's, you know, older than today's newspaper. But, you know, I was telling the cast yesterday, right before opening, that I remember starting to write Palestine, and I took apart my king-size bed, and from the wooden planks of the bed, I made a writing table. And I'm a little, not superstitious, but, you know, you just like your nice writing table to be a place that's welcoming and that you enjoy. And Stephen King writes a lot about the process and how he has created this, you know, captain's writing table, and he couldn't write anything there. You set up a little wood box over there and you write, like, you know, and that's tricky that way. But there was something about the wood planks, and then I made a little cot for myself. I just was trying to emulate what a soldier might be going to, so that I wasn't writing at Starbucks or Pete's Cafe, or, you know, I needed to feel in a way, I not make it a hardship for myself, but, you know, it was just an effort of trying to lay bare and write, you know, in a honest way. But from that moment on, just in reading Names of the Dead every day in the paper, and just, you know, watching it shift from this deadly Iraq battle to Afghanistan, and I'm glad that we did pay attention and that we kind of shifted with the where the war efforts would go. We kind of had to pay attention to that part. Mike brought in a military advisor that was also wanting us to get things correct. And my father's an old Navy guy, anytime we move into the military world, whether it be San Diego or Washington, D.C., you really got to get it right, because you can really, you know, just that attention to detail, which... the military is, if not anything, pays attention to military. So even though we're depicting it, and our overall statement is anti-war, because we're depicting it, we've got to depict it, you know, in an honest
way. It still feels reverential towards people that are fighting. There's never a moment where it feels like it's sort of like anti...
Well, I figured out, Mike, that thing where people say, even if you don't support the war, you support the troops. And I wondered, well, that's a bumper sticker, but I really figured out how to do that, because there are kids coming back in flag-draped coffins, and that's a heartbreak. And I bet you Costco's jam-packed right now. I bet you Walmart is jam-packed right now. We don't necessarily want to see that part of the story, but it's going to play front and center. And you don't need to make much of a anti-war statement other than that, you know? And I found, being a multiculturalist that I am, that that's one time in America where it truly does not matter what color the young man or woman is in that. And that's not jingoistic. Oh, we're all Americans. It's someone coming home. It's someone's kid. It's someone's husband. It's someone's daughter. And I think the play tries to hopefully depict and deal with that. And in a real way.
Your writing is incredibly lyrical, to say the least. And I know that you mentioned your father earlier, and I believe he is a poet. And I wanted to talk to you about sort of the use of poetry both in your writing and how that sort of came about, and when you were trying to find your voice, how difficult was that sort of struggling with, you know, your father being a poet as well?
Well, it's been a great, you know, tool and a great blessing to have my father, Jose, who really was one of the early Chicano poets that really helped articulate, you know, the movement. I mean, I remember that my dad was very much in the inner circles with, you know, Cesar, Chavez, and as the intellectuals were trying to figure out, well, what is the movement, you know, and the artists. And they were very helpful to the movement because, you know, if you need 1,000 lawn signs, the artists are going to do them, you know. Or if you need a mural or if you need a large flag, it's really the artist. Or if you need theater like Luis Valdez's Teatro Campesino, or if you need someone to capture, that's what the black intellectuals did. And my dad, and as a child, I was lucky enough to observe all of that. I've stolen his poetry on many times. I've tried to emulate it. I've tried to surpass it. You know, can sometimes be not so much a cloud, but it's, you know, Jose is a giant.
It's a presence.
He's a giant in the Chicano literary world, and still very active, and still, you know, publishing. And I just go back and read his poems sometimes, and I just like that, the economy of words and the beauty of them. Because I think young poets sometimes, in the spoken word phenomenon, I sometimes feel there's a lack of discipline in that. Because to write lyrically, you can just, you know, write over and over. And it's I, and I. What I loved about the early Chicano and Chicano poets, it was we. It was the movement. It was like a farm worker died today of heat exhaustion. We clashed with the Teamsters in the fields. It, you know, a young Chicano kid is killed by Dallas Police Department. It wasn't this frickin' I got up today, and I, you know, it was, and that's what I see a lot in the cafes and the spoken word thing, and that's, there's a lot of great poetry going on, but I get a little impatient, and it can be a trap also. Like if you look at the early drafts of Palestine, New Mexico, they were lyrical and cyclical, and It working, Mike's a dramaturg and really had a hand in helping me figure out, along with John Glore and our director and the Culture Clash guys that have turned into good dramaturgs, but really adding a level of discipline to the writing is can be a good thing. It is for me, because I'll just write in a circle forever and because I do believe people talk that way. I believe that a conversation at a bar or a cafe can be all over the map. We don't speak in organized paragraphs. And I do find sometimes that people want to organize and restructure your stuff. So it's that fine line of wanting to have a coherent piece that an audience can find and staying true to the lyrical part that's in us. You know, someone a lot wiser than me said that in a political campaign, you campaign in poetry, but once you get into office, it's prose. And I feel like that way at the writing table, it's poetic. But then you get into the public rehearsal process, and no one can make sense of your poetry, and it becomes a kind of a prose, a stronger narrative, hopefully.
Along those lines of the narrative, I mean, one of your hallmarks since the very beginning has been your ability to really have an acute comedic sense of timing. And how difficult is it, or was it, specifically with Palestine, trying to find that balance between sort of the gravitas of the subject matter and also, you know, the culture clash comedic mentality? How hard is it to really nail those things down?
Well, you know, I was talking to Mike about, you know, the reviews are coming out and there's some favorable stuff, and I think we're really going to be taken to task because of the humor and I was fighting it for a long time with this piece. I didn't want it to be pitch in its darkness, but I sometimes feel there's an audience expectation and even from some of our team that there's an expectation for culture clash to be culture clash. And I think that each audience member will have to decide whether there's a place for that in a piece like Palestine. I believe there is, because the res is a a place where humor really lives. It can be a bleak, stark place, but it also can be a place where there's a great deal of humor going on. But it just has to be calibrated, and it's risky. You know, I think humor belongs in Palestine, New Mexico.
Yes.
And I think that it works, but I think that if a reviewer wants to be grumpy about it, they're going to take us to task and saying, you know, a shtick, or this is vaudeville, and life seems to have a bit of both in each and every day, so that's how we depict it.
I think there's a good balance of it in the show, and I think that without it, I do believe it would sort of feel like you were just sort of like sinking. But it does need something to break it up, and I feel like it, again, it's all in service of the play. It doesn't feel like all of a sudden there's a pie fight in the middle of the show. I mean, it's not that absurd or ridiculous. There seems to be there's heart to it behind it as well, and sort of, I think you guys found a really great balance between the two.
It takes a lot of, thank you for that, but I think this is play number 4 or 5 at the Taper, and I'm just amazed that they don't get easier. You know, they actually get harder, because people remember, well, Chavez Ravine was my favorite, or Water and Power was my favorite. And so the expectation as people come back are like, you know, and it's daunting sometimes.
But then again, you guys are growing. I mean, this is the first play I think the Taper has done that's helped you grow outside of a Los Angeles aesthetic, and that, you know, it is set in New Mexico. And
mm-hmm.
And how much did you feel like that was an important part of your sort of growth process as well, of moving to a different, telling a different people's story?
A lot of fun, you know, and it just kind of opens it up to the great Southwest, and, you know, to have Russell Means, you know, who plays Chief Birdsong in this piece. Russell comes out of the American Indian Movement and is a controversial figure himself. I just felt it was time to not just speak to identity, you know, in Los Angeles or East LA, but I thought it was time that America would, it's time to hear from someone wiser than you or me.
I find that
on the reservations in the Southwest, you find people that have lived and have seen, and, you know, our other piece, Culture Clash in America, we were realizing that it's a show of monologues and people that many of the people on that show are veterans of war. And where we've left the veterans of war are underneath freeway on-ramps and in places called, you know, the People's Park in Berkeley. These are homeless people, and they have seen much more than we have. And we try to go there and pay attention and get that story. And you find them on the res, and you find them in the penitentiary. And it's always blown us away that's where you find this rich American narrative that is running in the margins of Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly and the loud TV. There's these people over here that have a lot to say. So it seemed a good time to see what a chief has to say right now. And that surprised me a lot, because I found a great deal of patriotism on Native American reservations. The first female casualty in this conflict was a Native American, you know, mother, you know. The first casualty in the conflict was a Salvadoran kid that was just trying to become a U.S. citizen. You find different stories. There's always something going on underneath, you know, the headline.
I'd love to actually break out of this for a little bit and open up to some questions, if you guys have them. And if you don't, Richard and I will just continue our comedy troupe up here. But yes, there's a question down here. I think there's going to be some microphones to help everybody be heard, which will be helpful. Because when I have to repeat questions, it's usually just dreadful. You guys are much smarter than I am.
Maybe you could say a little bit about your two pieces at the Getty, where you're going back to Greek classics and then mixing them up.
You're referring to a piece that we did this summer. I didn't hear the question. I'm just
again, if you,
I'm just rolling with it.
He asked about the two pieces at the Getty that were done recently, some of the Greeks. And now Richard will say some brilliant things about that.
Well, we've been really drawn to Aristophanes, who was a Greek comedy writer, wrote the comedies. He was part of, you know, he was a sitcom comedy writer for the Greek civilization.
Back in the 50s. Big hit on CBS.
Yeah. We've always really loved his work because it was so biting and satirical and sharp commentary about the decline of that civilization or whatever war was going on at that time. And so we've found amazing parallels with that civilization and ours. And we did the birds a couple of years ago, and more recently we took the original text from Peace, and we go through different translations of them, and then we mash them up with our how we want to update it or butcher it or cut it up or something. But man, his plays were just amazing and sharp and always something to do with a sheep. very profane and profound and a rich, rich body of work. Man, I'm glad he doesn't have an agent because, but those Greek comedies and the tragedies are there and they're rich, rich original texts.
In 2,000 years, do you want someone to take your work and do the same thing you're doing into Aristophanes?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Yeah. Just makes it. You won't have an agent by then either, I think, so.
No. thank you. Richard, could you say a little bit more about your research process for Palestine? I mean, you know, was it organized? Did you, you know, how did you go out and find stories? You know, were all three of you out there, you know, wandering the res? What was, how did this come into being? What was your process?
Well, I knew it would deal with the war and the after effects of war, and there's been so much written and so much available. You can go online and actually read soldiers' blogs and watch video. I didn't necessarily feel I had to go interview people for that part of it. The New Mexican part was, you know, my aunts, my uncles, my dad, and then just getting in a rental car and driving up and down and stopping and going into shops and trying to get on the res and talking to the man or the woman next to me at a diner. And I remember there was a secondhand store down by La Mesilla, New Mexico, which is near Las Cruces, and a really beautiful area. And I was really drawn to this elderly Anglo woman that ran not a secondhand shop, but you know, where you could buy old yard stuff and statues. And I kept going back every day because this woman was just really fascinating. And her humor was you know, beyond mine. And I went back one day and she was there and I was thinking about buying this thing. And I realized I wasn't really there to buy more stuff that fills up my house. But it was a really hot summer day. And I said, you know, is there a swimming hole around here? Or is there a place that, you know, only the locals know? Like, I heard about some waterfalls and, you know, it's really hot. And without, you know, missing a beat, she was like, well, I'd send you to the Rio Grande, which is about a mile away, but they might not let you back in. And she let out a laugh, and I wrote it down as fast as I could. And I found that kind of humor in that El Paso, New Mexico area is like you're a stranger and you're just taken for your word. And you have this trust that they will sit down and have a cup of coffee with you. Or it just seems to be something old in America about that we're missing now because we're tweeting and we're, you know,
I'm gonna do that right now, actually.
Instant messaging and all the things that I do a million times a day. But there's something about the old American conversation that involves a chief, and it involves an older Anglo woman, it involves a farm worker, it involves that thing that Woody did and those guys did. They went out and gathered those stories.
You told a great story at some point during rehearsals about a specific sign that you, I don't want to give away the punchline, but a specific sign you saw on a shop, I believe. It comes up a lot in the play. Do you know what I'm talking about now? No. I don't know if you've read the play.
Circumcision.
Yeah, circumcision. Yes, yeah.
No, I mean, I was somewhere between Belen and Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, and those towns are as stark as they sound. I mean, they just, there's a football field and a desert and a water tower, and, you know, you move through Maxwell, New Mexico, and these places, and I'm driving on the Highway 25 down there, and just looking after ridge after ridge after ridge, an abandoned car, and then a sunken ravine, and then a mesa, and then a playa, and then a cloud cover, and really beautiful. And out of nowhere, I look to my right, and I'm driving south 25, and I see this large lighted sign, and all it is a Star of David. And that's all it is. I'm like, man, someone's messing with me. And so I pull off the road and I go down this dirt road to get to it. And it's like, says synagogue 50 feet away. And I look and it's just a trailer. It's like there's three trailers. One's a schoolhouse, one's a synagogue, one's a Catholic church. And I'm like, this is wild. Trailer park.
You're like,
synagogue.
I'm home.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm home. Thank you. It turns out that for the people that worship in that area, that would be their little trailer, you know, synagogue, and unadorned, and like I say, you know, laid bare, and not fancy at all. So I took a lot of pictures of it, but was desperately looking for someone around there to talk to. And I later found people in Albuquerque that shared with me stories that are in the show now, and a newsletter. A Latino newsletter of New Mexicans that are both Mexican and have the Sephardic connection in their family.
More questions? Yes, in the back.
I've seen your play, which I enjoyed very much, but I have to tell you, I found it very hard to believe that there was a Sephardic heritage there. If there is, I think it's one of the world's best kept secrets.
She's seen the play and said that she found it almost unbelievable that there's a Sephardic connection to that sort of that section of America. And it does, it actually feels, I'll speak a little bit first because I did some research on it for Richard as well. But in fact, just this morning I got sent an article, and I think it might have been in Harper's, about a Jewish writer from New York who goes specifically to New Mexico to find the crypto-Jews that live there, and talks at length about how, everything that Richard says in the play, that long speech that Maria 15 gives in the early part of the play, is in a sense true. And it is sort of crazy that you never stop to think about it. But so there actually is, Richard wasn't just making it up. You were just making it up. Oh my God. We just found out that you were making it up.
No. No, I think, you know, the reasons for the secrecy and even shame and fear and ignorance and superstition, enough superstition to lead to hate and Jewish blood spilled on New Mexican soil is worthy of my exploration and true. And I found a number of stories where it was, in fact, you know, not, I wouldn't make up something that big, but whether or not my family is or not makes it no less interesting to me and other families. I know of young academics that went all the way to Spain, and you can get the Inquisition books opened, and you can see your family name on both sides of the ledger. I know there are Montoyas in that ledger, and I'm wondering, you know, on my grandmother's side, what's this other name that is Punisher and Punished, you know? So, And then I had stories, you know, in the great oral tradition, just people that would come up to me and tell me and share a story with me, still in hushed, you know, tones. And we don't think of it as needing to be a secret anymore, but these folks weren't that far from the Inquisition and the need for secrecy and the need to, as the play asserts, find Passover songs hidden inside Mexican border music. I mean, for a guy that helped co-found a thing called Culture Clash, that's like...
Done.
I couldn't make that up. That was... That's like, you know, that should get two more plays, you know? Or mezuzahs embedded behind Virgin Mary statues, or if people didn't know how to properly advance the rosary beads, the rumors would start, you know? They're in church, they're holding them, but they're not advancing them properly.
The article was fascinating, too, because it basically said that a lot of people just assumed that was their particular form of Catholicism, was to have these weird, specific to them, New Mexican rituals. You're like, well, no. there's an entire different tradition behind you that is for that. So it's really great. And the people, it talks to a historian who went there to sort of start writing a little bit of a history of New Mexico, people coming in still secretive and saying things like, we don't eat pork. Is that weird? And sort of, but like looking around, like the way he describes it, you're like, you are lying. This is obviously fake. But there's still a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, people lighting Friday candles, you know, and it's for me, you know, it this lady came to me. We were performing in Albuquerque, and I was just Palestine was just a poem then, but I read it, and there was just a line of people waiting to talk to me after the show. Didn't necessarily want an autograph. They just wanted to share a story. And that's where I found out about the a rug weaver from a little town called Chimayo, whose Navajo rugs ended up in mosques and synagogues in Morocco. And so that's reverse diaspora for me. That's going the other way. And then the cacti practically grows in the shape of menorahs in New Mexico. And then up and down Highway 25, towns are given interesting names. I mean, there's Las Cruces, Belen, Santa Fe, San Miguel. And that's like, you know, Jewish person, don't stop here. And Indian, you keep going. And that's all in the play, you know. And I hope that the audience is getting that strange, you know, culture clash in the piece.
There's a question down here, I believe. Ooh, wait, we have a wonderful microphone for you. Yes.
But you know, we're using wonderful. The mic and everyone wants the question repeated.
I know.
I haven't seen the new play.
Uh-huh.
But
that's okay.
Water and Power was an incredible play. And I'm wondering about the creative process. When you went to New Mexico and you gathered this information and you bring it back and the three of you work together then to create the play, or have you written the play and then what happens?
Well, let me see. Plays like Chavez Ravine and Bola Beans and The Mission and our early works were very much in the collective spirit. And then we'd interface with our team, directors, dramaturgs, hopefully someone to commission the piece. but Water and Power was a slight variation of that, in that I just felt that I could write it alone. And a little faster, and just be a little bit more nimble about it. Rick and Herb, you know, are raising families and have, you know, it's complicated to get together 3-4 times a week. It's just not. I think people still sometimes think that we have a clubhouse and that we hang out.
You don't?
My mom thinks we still have 3 bunk beds.
I thought all of this was true.
It's all true, yeah. And so given all the limitations and challenges of just being a writer, you know, let alone trying to write with 2 other guys. Yeah. And what's neat about the group is that we'll go back and we'll do the collective thing for peace, and then our next piece, you know, will be in the collective spirit. But something that's so personal, I felt that Water and Power was really needed to explore Chicano fatalism, frankly. That there's that thing in us that our dads did to their sons, and with good intentions, but it has to be explored in the way that the Jewish writers did, and the Italian writers, and the Irish writers. You know, I couldn't believe there hadn't been a Water and Power before about ambition, at a time when we were still drunk with the happiness of a new Chicano mayor in L.A. and the political ramifications of that. It seemed to be time to look at the underbelly of that. I'd wish he'd come to see the show.
But there's also a sort of...
Or that newscaster thing. or the Orange County sheriff that's on his way to prison. Or, you know, it's a long, long list. And I admire our mayor a great deal. He hasn't done anything, you know, like the Orange County sheriff or, you know, the Chicago alderman or that sort of thing. But this derailment that powerful men and women do is from Elliot Spitzer to, well, I don't know, what was Tiger Woods? It's fascinating to watch, isn't it? Yeah.
Question over here, yes. Well, what's the microphone? Yes.
Yes, of course, I've lived here a long time, and there was quite a quiet Jewish community here, even though some of the bigger developers of Los Angeles were Jewish. And I have to say that some of our friends, parents and grandparents, were diverted from Ellis Island because it was full and they had to land in Texas and come up through and settle in El Paso, for example. So I can see where there could be quite a powerful settlement there of Ladinos, too.
Mm-hmm. Even more powerful on stage at the Mark Taper Forum right now, Palestine, New Mexico. Yes, in the back.
Thanks. First of all, I have to say that my mother's from New Mexico, and we have some of these stories as well, and the secrets, especially the secrets. But I'm curious, I'm actually very interested to know the sort of rationale for the title. When I think of Palestine, New Mexico, I have to admit that for years I have thought about how New Mexico is this place that really holds onto the history of conquest in many, many ways. The U.S. Mexican War being one of them. And how we have these layers of different peoples having been conquered, still having very active cultures and interacting. I'd like to hear from you what the title meant to you.
I titled the play Palestine, New Mexico because Richard Montoya told me to. So I'll pass it back to you.
Well, I mean, it was provocative, and there's a line in the play that answers it, you know, directly that may or may not be satisfying. But I loved the idea of homeland, and that in the old Hebrew books that I was researching, the word Palestine was used. And then certainly the Palestinians used the word Palestine. But this idyllic idea of homeland is always a shifting, tricky, slippery idea. Aslan, you know, we had held out for many years that, you know, parts of the Southwest would be our Chicano homeland, in a sense, and in some ways it was, and it has been, but you still can't find Aslan in a Thomas Guide anywhere. It's still an idea, you know. It's still here. It's not. It's or it's here, or you know. But it doesn't. Does it exist, or does it not exist? And so, Palestine, New Mexico, is a fictitious place, but I was interested in that idea of homeland. And if it exists or if it doesn't. And so it seemed to have a poetic ring to it, but it was like, what is it? There's Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and there's a couple other places that have, you know, odd sounding names like that. But the particular tribe that's depicted in the play called it that
to purposely anger the tribe down the road, you know, that was thought of being the Jewish tribe. So they would call their reservation Palestine. Yes, sir.
You had mentioned earlier, and I think I read it in the downtown news article that's in the paper today. I don't know if you saw that, but that you found that there was patriotism on the reservation. And I thought, boy, if there's ever a group of people who might not have that trait, I would have expected to find that on a reservation. Can you talk about that a little bit? Why you felt that, or why there is, or...
Well, there's some great books and some great imagery online, but even talking to Russell Means and some of the several Native American actors in the show, that their legacy to being warriors is still alive. And certainly you find anti-war sentiments. And lots of discussion about the feds still to this day. You also have young men and women out of economic hardship that opt out for military service. And you'll find older, you know, veterans of foreign war people that applaud that or won't judge it but will honor them. And so some of the most moving photography that I've seen would be the flag-draped coffins that are making their way back to the reservations. And it's done with great tradition. And drum and flute and ribbon shirts and the chief and the tribe. And there is some really heartbreaking photos where, you know, the soldier will, you know, lay in state, you know, under a teepee inside a high school auditorium. And so we try to depict that in this show. Like, what would it really be like if someone came home?
There's a wonderful chapter in a book called Final Salute, which talks about a Native American casualty, and it goes through the process. It's a very, very depressing but very sort of enlightening book about what happens when soldiers die, and it talks about the Native American, the path basically of the coffin to the reservation and what happens there. It's really incredibly moving, as well as some pictures.
Yeah, and the U.S. government tried to keep that from us for so long, but what happens when you know, the casualty goes, you know, from Iraq or Afghanistan to Ramstein and Germany to Dover to the military base. Many times those coffins end up in public airports. And this photographer tracked several of them and took photos of them as they were, you know, going into the payload of a passenger airplanes. And the photos are remarkable because you can see the passengers seeing it, and that reverence, I guess, I'm interested in it, that we still take a moment. And the photos capture it stunning, and it just stops you. You must stop. The captain doesn't even have to tell the passengers to be quiet. We do this thing. If you're violently opposed to the war, or you're you know, or you're not, for that moment, you must be still. You must be quiet. You must observe.
Two more questions. Yes, sir. You in the corner. Yes. Oh, wait a second. Yeah, I knew that was going to happen.
Could you tell us about the writing process for the wonderful show on Fox, 18 years ago? and how many other... I don't remember the credits for the writers, but who else did you employ from your troupe? I'm like, everybody wrote, or what?
I heard of what, team. I want to give a little bit of backstory to this story.
Uh-huh. Mid-90s, we did 30 episodes for the local Fox station, and it went actually to 7 different markets. Chicago, San Antonio, and we just found ourselves in this weird place where they're actually letting us do a weekly sketch show. I remember Rupert Murdoch coming to one of our tapings and
just loving it.
And us being out of work shortly thereafter. Because we were doing some wild things, man. We had x-rays coming out of Pete Wilson's eyes and zapping people back to Mexico. And again, we did not know better, and those shows looked great. I mean, they were you know, we didn't care if we had money. We wanted to spend money on the show and get it out there. And it was, you know, written and produced and starred, you know, Culture Clash, which was a first of its kind up until that point. But there's 30 of them out there, and they exist, and we bootleg them, and they're we can't even get Fox to admit they exist. Like, they're like, "What tapes are you talking about?" We're like, "We could repackage these. We should." And so out of the 30 shows, there was approximately 5 sketches per show. So there's 100 and some odd sketches out there, and some of them are really good. Not all of them are, but. We did some really clever and some really political stuff. Writing on that show was other playwrights, Josefina Ramirez, or is it Josefina Lopez? Lopez, yes. Lalo, who does the, Alcaraz, this guy knows all the writers here. We lucked out with some big time writers too. Steve Higgins is the main writer on Jimmy Fallon show now, and people that moved on and we're really good, and it was just a great playpen for us to try some things that you can't really do in the theater because it takes so much money.
Have you ever considered doing like a one night of at least sort of reading through your favorite sketches from the TV show? Or
yeah.
Were you afraid that Fox would sue you back to the Stone Age?
No. I think the Television Museum here should take a good long look at some of those shows. There were some that were very revolutionary for their time and well-produced and They were like really, some really wild, wild stuff. Yes. I have some questions down here.
I was going to say I was in at Stanford University in 1986 when you performed before the Mecha statewide conference. You received a really good reception. I remember Jose Antonio Burciaga doing The Anatomy of a Pedo, which was hilarious. As the whole troupe was, but I actually wanted to say, maybe in your opinion, what happened to the Chicano groups? Because there were like hundreds of them, as you mentioned, in the 1970s and the 80s, and then they pretty much died out in the 90s, and now you just have a handful. So I just wanted to know what's your opinion of the downfall.
The downfall. Wow.
You have 30 seconds.
Reagan Bush and.
Thank you very much.
Those were interesting times at Stanford at that time. Condoleezza Rice was, I think the provost, yeah. And the Burciagas were basically run out of Stanford because they ran afoul of Condoleezza, which gives you an idea of that. I believe the Hoover Institution is based there in Stanford and they're around. They watched our work. And Jose Antonio Burciaga was a great humorist and passed away a number of years ago, but we still see his wife and his children. And we're thinking about doing a one-man show or a show based on his work, his writings, because it was so, so great. I don't know what happened, except that they were in the 80s and coming out of the 70s and even early 90s. There were just more art collectives around. There were centros everywhere. There were murals everywhere. There was... And I think just like everything else that went away of its kind like that, that, you know, it feels like, you know, the school lunch program, you know, it feels like so many things that went away. And a lot of it, I think, was economy. And those of us that really believed in the nonprofits and the not-for-profits and the collective way of doing things, the good news is that many of those things turned into other things and that can still be traced and tracked, Culture Clash being one of them. Other younger than us sort of art collectives and kids coming out of art school wanting to emulate that idea. But I think it was just really tough economic times that heyday for that was ran about 10 years and then the grants dried up. You know, what was it?
who had a CETA job back in the 80s? There go the hey, Ernie, I know you had one, Ernie. CETA. What happened to CETA, man? And you know, I don't know what the magic formula is for now, unless you're a large institution, you know. It looks like we may be getting a home in MacArthur Park, and but there's great concern, like, well, how would you maintain your home if you actually were to receive a home? How do you maintain it? And which makes our relationship with Center Theater Group, I think, just to say a quick word about that, kind of remarkable that they've actually given us a home over the years. And so, yeah, Mike personally is responsible for that. Want to thank Mike, but it's
been difficult, you guys.
Yeah, and we haven't stolen anything, and
that is not true at all.
And so we've been, and that's terribly helpful. You know, it's I say we used to tour the U.S., but now we tour L.A. I mean, we were in Malibu in the summer, and then we go down to Orange County, then you go up to Northridge, or you go out to Riverside, or you're at the Taper, and you can tour Los Angeles and see different audiences in every part of L.A., and that's like, that's the part of L.A. I really love, and that's what makes it so different than the Bay Area, or even New York, or Chicago. It's like, you can tour the basin, and it's very, very different, and the different parts of L.A. So I really hope that you guys do come out to see the new work. It's interesting to keep doing new work on the heels of Peace, which was a brand new work. And then right after this, a brand new piece called American Night for Oregon Shakespeare Festival up in Ashland in the summer of this next summer. There'll be a brand new piece up there, which we're really looking forward to.
I want to thank all of you for coming. Specifically, I want to thank Richard as well for sitting on stage with me.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.